"This one is strong enough," Robin thought. And then she shouted, "Help me, Zuga! For God's sake, Robin!" She crawled forward and reached the black child, and the deck tilted viciously under her, fresh cold water bursting into the hull. "Leave her!" shouted Zuga. The fresh flood swirled up around Robin's head, and the chained girl disappeared below it. Robin lunged for her, groping blindly below the surface, feeling panic rise in her when she could not find the child. Ducking her head under, choking as the pain in her belly made her gasp and she swallowed water, she at last got a grip on the girl's shoulder, feeling her struggling as desperately as she. Together they came out above the surface, coughing and gasping weakly, Robin holding the girl's mouth just clear of the surface. But when she tried to lift her further, the chain anchored them both, and she screamed, "Zuga! Help me!" Another surge of water, smelling like raw sewage, filled her mouth, and both of them went under once more. She thought she would never come up again. But stubbornly she held on, sliding one arm under the girl's armpit, and with the other hand gripping her chin, forcing it up so that when they broke out again, the girl's face was tilted to take another precious breath of the stinking air. And Zuga was with them. He took a double turn of the chain around his wrists and threw all his weight onto it. In the gloom of the howl, he towered over them, the light from the hatch highlighting the bulging wet muscles in his arms and shoulders as he strained at the chain, his mouth opened in a silent scream of effort, sinewy cords standing out of his throat. Another wave hissed over them, and this time Robin was not ready for it. She felt the burn of it in her lungs and knew she was drowning. She need only release her hold on the girl's head and shoulders, and she would be free to breathe. But she held on stubbornly, determined suddenly that she would never let this little soul go. She had seen it in the girl's eyes, the fierce will to live. This one she could save. This one, out of 300 or more, was the only one she could be certain of saving. She had to have her. The wave receded, and Zuga was still there, his hair streaming with water, slicked down over his face and into his eyes, and now he shifted slightly, jamming his legs against one of the heavy timbers, and he reared back once more against the chain, and a low bellow broke from his throat in the agony of effort. The ring bolt that held the loop of chain to the deck ripped out cleanly, and Zuga dragged both women clear of the water, the chain slithering after them for 10 feet or more before coming up hard against the next ring bolt. Robin had never suspected Zuga capable of such strength. She had never seen his naked upper body, not since he was a child, had not realized that he had the lean, hard muscle of a prize fighter. But even so, he could not repeat the effort, and the girl was still chained. They had won only a temporary respite. Zuga was bellowing now, and the young naval ensign scrambled down through the open hatch. To re-enter the doomed howl was an act of courage in itself, Robin realized, as she saw that the ensign carried the cutting shears, lugging the heavy tool with him as he floundered towards the struggling group in the bottom of the hold. The howl rolled through another 5 degrees, the water swirling higher towards them, hungrily. It sucked at their bodies. Had not Zuga given them the extra few feet of chain, they would be far below the surface now. Zuga stooped over her and helped her hold the black girl's head above the water while the ensign groped for the chain links and fed them into the jaws of the shears. But the blades had been blunted and chipped by the heavy work they had already done, and the ensign was still only a lad. Zuga pushed him aside. Again, muscle bunched in his shoulders and upper arms, and the chain parted with a metallic clunk. Zuga cut twice at the ankle and at the wrist. Then he dropped the shears, picked the frail naked body up against his chest, and climbed frantically up towards the hatch. Robin tried to follow him, but something tore deep in her belly. She felt it go, tearing like brittle parchment, and the pain was a lance that transfixed her. She doubled over it, clutching herself, unable to move, and the wave hit her, knocking her down, swirling her over the broken timbers into the dark waters, and the darkness began to fill her head. There was temptation to let go now, to let the water and darkness take her. It would be so easy. But she gathered her anger and her obstinacy to her and went on fighting. She was still fighting when Zuga reached her and dragged her up towards the light. As they crawled out through the hatch into the sunlight, so the dhal rolled all the way, flinging them, as though from a catapult, over the side into the shocking cold of the green waters. As the dhal capsized, so the last faint cries from within her were extinguished, and the howl began to break up under the remorseless hammer of the sea. When Robin and Zuga surfaced, still clinging together, the whaler was hovering above them, the ensign risking all to come in over the reef for the pickup. Strong hands reached down, and the overladen boat heeled dangerously as they were pulled aboard. Then the ensign swung the bows to meet the next boiling line of surf, and they climbed its steep side and crashed over the top, the seaman pulling frantically to hold her bows on. Robin crawled to where the black girl lay on a heap of other bodies in the bottom of the boat, her relief at finding her aboard and still alive, outweighing the pain of her sodden lungs and the deep ache in her belly. Robin rolled the girl onto her back and lifted her lolling head to cushion it from the pounding of the whaler's hull over the steep swells that threatened to crack her skull against the floorboards. She saw immediately that the girl was older than she had imagined, although the body was desiccated, dried out and wasted. Yet her pelvis had the breadth of maturity. She would be 16 years old at least, Robin thought, and pulled a corner of the tarpaulin over her body to screen her from the men's gaze. The girl opened her eyes again and stared at Robin solemnly. Those eyes were still the colour of dark honey, but the ferocity had dimmed to some other emotion as she looked up into Robin's face. "Ngiyabonga," the girl whispered. And with a shock, Robin realized that she understood the words. She was transported in an instant to another land and another woman, her mother, Helen Ballantyne, teaching her those same words, repeating them to her until Robin had them perfected. "Ngiyabonga, I praise you." Robin tried to find a reply, but her mind was as battered as her body. And it had been so long ago that she had learned the language, the circumstances so different, that the words came only haltingly. "Valepiwena, who are you, and from where do you come?" The black girl's eyes flew wide with shock. "You," she whispered, "you speak the language of the people." They had taken on board 28 living black girls. By the time Black Joke got underway again and turned from the land towards the open sea, the dhal's hull had burst open and the planking and timbers swung and pitched end over end as they soared across the exposed reef. A squawking, raucous flock of seabirds squabbled over the reef, hovering above the gruesome remnants that were mixed in the floating debris of the wreck, dropping to seize a titbit and rise again on the delicate fans of pearly wings. In the deeper water along the seaward side of the reef, the shark packs were gathered, lashing themselves into a frenzy, the stubby, rounded triangles of their dorsal fins criss-crossing the green sweep of the current, while every few seconds a long torpedo-shaped body would break clear of the surface in an ecstasy of greed, falling back heavily with a boom like distant cannon as it struck the surface. 28 from 300 and more was no great haul, Robin thought, as she hobbled along the line of barely living bodies, her own bruised limbs protesting every step, and her despair deepened as she realized how far gone they were. It was easy to see which of them had already lost the will to resist. She had read her father's treaty on the sick African, and she knew how important this will to resist was in treating a primitive people. A perfectly healthy man could will himself to death, and once he did so, there was nothing that could save him. That night, despite Robin's constant attention, 22 of the girls died and were carried aft to be dropped over Black Joke's stern. By morning, all the others were sinking into the coma and fever of renal failure, their kidneys shriveled and atrophied by lack of fluid, were no longer filtering the urinal wastes from the body's systems. There was only one treatment, and that was to force the patient to drink. The little Nguni girl resisted strongly. Robin knew that she belonged to the Nguni group of peoples, although she was uncertain of which tribe, for many of them spoke variations of the original Zulu, and the girl's accent and pronunciation had been strange to Robin's ear. Robin had tried to keep her talking, keep her conscious, and keep the will to resist burning in her. She had conceived an almost maternal possessiveness for the child, and though she tried to spread her attention fairly amongst the other survivors, she always returned to where the girl lay under a strip of tarpaulin and held the pannikin of weak sugar solution to her lips. They shared only a few hundred words in which to converse, as the girl rested between each painful sip of fluid. "I am called Juba," the child whispered, in answer to Robin's question. Even the sound of it brought back to Robin the memory of the cooing of the plump blue-grey ring-necked doves in the wild fig trees that grew above the mission cottage in which she had been born. "Little dove, it is a pretty name." And the girl smiled shyly, and went on in that dry, tortured whisper. Much of it Robin could not follow, but she listened and nodded, realizing with a pang that the sense of it was going. Juba was sinking into delirium, that she was talking to phantoms from her past. Now she tried to resist when Robin forced her to drink, muttering and crying out in fear or anger, gagging on the tiny mouthfuls of liquid. "You must rest yourself," Zuga told Robin brusquely. "You've been with her for almost 2 days without sleeping. You're killing yourself." "I'm quite well, thank you," Robin told him. But her face was gaunt and white with fatigue and pain. "At least let me take you down to your cabin." By this time, Juba was the only black girl still alive. All the others had gone over the stern to feed the following shark pack. "Very well," Robin agreed. And Zuga carried the child down from the makeshift shelter on the aft deck which Robin had used as a surgery. The steward brought a canvas pallet filled with straw and laid it on the deck of Robin's tiny cabin. There was only just room for it, and Zuga laid the naked body upon it. Robin was tempted to stretch out on her own narrow bunk to rest for a while, but she knew that if she let go now, even for a moment, she would fall into a death-like sleep, and her patient would die of such neglect. Alone in the cabin, she sat cross-legged on the straw pallet, wedged her back against the sea-chest, and lifted Juba into her lap. Doggedly she went on with the task of forcing liquid between the girl's lips, drop by drop, hour after hour. Through the single port, the light turned to a ruby glow at the short tropical sunset, and then it swiftly faded. It was almost completely dark in the cabin, when suddenly Robin felt a copious warm flood soaking through her skirts into her lap, and she smelt the strong ammoniacal taint of the girl's urine. "Thank you, God," she whispered. "Oh, thank you, God." The girl's kidneys were functioning again. She was safe. Robin rocked the girl in her lap, feeling no revulsion from her soaked skirts, welcoming them as the promise of life. "You did it," she whispered. "You did with sheer pluck, my little dove." She had just enough strength left herself to wipe down the child's body with a cloth soaked in seawater. Then she stepped out of her soiled dress and collapsed face down on her hard, narrow bunk. Robin slept for 10 hours, and then the cramps woke her groaning. Her knees were drawn up against her chest by the severity of the pain, and her belly muscles were hard as stone, and it felt as though she'd been clubbed across the back, a deep, bruised sensation that alarmed her seriously. For many minutes after waking, she believed herself seriously stricken, and then with a rush of relief and joy that was far stronger than the pain, she realized what was happening to her. She dragged herself across the cabin, doubled over with the pain, and bathed in the bucket of cold seawater. Then she knelt beside Juba on the pallet. The girl's fever had abated. The skin felt cooler to the touch. Her continued recovery added to Robin's sense of deep pleasure and relief. Now she would have to find the right moment to tell Clinton Codrington that she would not marry him. And the vision of the little house above the Portsmouth harbour receded. Despite the pain, she felt free, light of body, like a bird poised on the point of flight. She filled the pannikin with water and lifted Juba's head. "We will be all right now," she told the girl, and Juba opened her eyes. "We'll both be all right now," she repeated, watching the girl drink thirstily, smiling happily to herself.